First, I'd like to make a quick note about the prior speaker. Nami just graduated with a bachelor's degree, and next year she is going to be taking a gap year where she will be applying to graduate schools. I'm Tommy. I'm going to give part two of this two-talk sequence where I discuss the numerical methods. Since Nami's already given her talk, I don't need to do much of an overview, except to say that our long-term goal is to calculate the self force in Kerr space-time in Lorentz gauge and to avoid time instabilities by doing it in the frequency domain. By doing it in the frequency domain, we end up with elliptic partial differential equations, and that leads to some numerical challenges. I'm going to be saying a lot of things during this talk. I might say something like, we did this or we did that, when in reality, it was Nami who developed the Mathematica code to solve the scalar field equations. So what I really mean is Nami did all these things. And I'm just sort of reporting her results. As Nami said, the gravitational case looks hard. So we started off by calculating the scalar self-force to develop methods that hopefully would be applicable in the gravitational case for future work. And I'm going to talk about all sorts of interesting details about our numerical methods, starting with how we consider a domain that is a rectangular grid in the R star theta plane, and how we apply a finite difference scheme that leads to algebraic equations that we solve, and all sorts of interesting things like how we improved the boundary conditions to make sure that we were able to achieve high accuracy with a relatively small size for the domain. And we'll look at convergence tests and results and all sorts of things like that. And then at the very end, I'll talk about future directions that you might take that are based on methods such as the ones that we are discussing today. First, let's take a look at the numerical grid. You might consider a cross-section that is, for example, a cross-section of constant R star. And that would be a cross-section like this, or you might look at a cross-section of constant theta. And what are the details we do to discretize the domain? If you look at a cross-section of constant R star that intersects the world two, we decided to have a numerical domain where the world two had a width of pi over 5 radians. That was a semi-arbitrary decision that we made. And then we use this integer k to control the resolution. And by making sure that the denominator is an odd number, it makes sure that none of our grid points fall exactly on the world line of the scalar charge. Because if a grid point fell on the world line, then it would cause issues with evaluating the functions for the effective source. We consider a cross section of constant theta. It's not symmetric anymore. We use this integer n to control the resolution in the R star direction. We choose a world tube diameter d, and then we measure all other lengths in units of that world tube diameter. So the smallest R star value in our domain is going to be an integer times the world tube diameter. And then the largest R star value in our domain will also be an integer times the world tube diameter. That feature makes it so that if we were to increase our resolution, the dimensions of the domain stay exactly the same even when the resolution increases. All right, I'll start off with a sort of a crash course in how to solve elliptic PDEs numerically with finite difference methods. Consider these blue positions. What does the scalar field equation have to say about the values of the scalar field at those five positions? Well, the scalar field equations involve second R star derivatives, they involve second theta derivatives, and we have an approximate representation of those partial derivatives involving finite differences between adjacent values. And so for each grid point, there's an unknown associated with that grid point, but there's also an algebraic equation associated with that grid point that is an approximate representation of the scalar field equation. And so if you go through all the grid points, in theory, you will accumulate as many algebraic equations as there are unknowns. And naturally, we would like to represent those algebraic equations as a matrix equation so that we can take advantage of the computational efficiencies of linear algebra. In order to express it as a matrix equation, we would want to take all of our unknowns and assemble them as a vector of unknowns. And to do that, we take one row of unknowns that are associated with a bunch of different theta positions. And those are the first elements in the vector. But then we stack below that vertically the next row of unknowns, and that would be at a different R star position. And by stacking each row vertically underneath the next, we have this big long vector of unknowns, and then we'll try to solve a matrix equation to find the value of all those unknowns. I'm jumping the gun here a little bit because we really can't solve the system of equations until we've talked about things like boundary conditions and how to handle the effective source. But let's just take a look at what the form of this matrix of coupling coefficients would look like. One of those algebraic equations would follow from multiplying a row of this matrix times the column vector of unknown quantities. And you can sort of convince yourself that this is the structure that the matrix should have. There's, if you look at a row of this matrix, there's three non-zero values all next to one another. And those are the finite difference coefficients for adjacent theta values. But then there's a big gap between these off-diagonal components. And that has to do with the fact that in order to go from one R value to another R value, which occurs when the first index changes, you have to jump a bunch of positions to go to adjacent R positions. And it wouldn't take long to analyze this to convince yourself that you would get a structure sort of like this. But things at the top and the bottom, for example, look different, and that is related to how we do boundary conditions, and so we'll talk about that later. Also, this source vector on the right-hand side is going to involve the effective source and the world tube, and I'd like to talk about that next. So let's imagine that we were considering a bunch of positions inside the world tube, and we applied the scalar field equation to see what sort of algebraic equation would follow from that. Well, inside the world tube, it's important to note that we're solving for a different type of field. We're solving for a regularized version of the field inside the world tube. But so long as all of the positions that encompassed in this finite difference stencil are inside the world tube, it's the same idea. We'll have a second R star derivative, we'll have a second theta derivative. All these unknowns would be the regularized version of the field. The difference is, instead of being equal to zero on the right-hand side, we would have that effective source. And we use Barry Wardell's C code to calculate that effective source because it was much faster computationally than the version we created in Mathematica. And we don't have any issues that we've encountered evaluating that effective source numerically, even right next to the world line, because we set up our grid so that the world line is centered in between grid points. So if you're completely outside the world tube or completely inside the world tube, it's pretty straightforward. It's just either the source is zero or the source is non-zero. But what if you were at a position where the finite difference stencil crossed the world tube? Well, since it's centered at a position outside the world tube for these purple positions, all of the unknowns that show up on the left side of the equation would involve the retarded field. But there's a problem. Because the finite difference stencil crosses the world tube, that algebraic finite difference equation would refer to a retarded field that does not appear in our vector of unknowns, because the vector of unknowns inside the world tube is solving for the regularized version of the field. So there's a subtlety here. We need to transform it into a version that does appear in our vector of unknowns, so we can represent that retarded field as a sum of the regularized field plus the puncture field. And then this one on the left does appear in our vector of unknowns. The one on the right, on the other hand, that is a known quantity. We also use Barry Wardell's C code to evaluate that puncture field. So we take the puncture field. Being a known quantity, it should appear on the other side of the equation and shouldn't have anything to do with the matrix of coupling coefficients. And so we put that known quantity on the other side of the equation. And through this process, the jumps associated with crossing the world tube are encoded by having the puncture field show up on the same side of the equation as the effective source. And through this process, the matrix of coupling coefficients are completely unaffected by the existence of the world tube. All right, let's talk about boundary conditions for a minute, because that's one of the challenges that was most difficult for us to overcome. I won't worry about talking about the theta boundary conditions. Those were pretty straightforward. However, the boundary conditions at the edges of the R star axis involve some subtleties. Nami talked about some idealized boundary conditions that are true only all the way out at R star equals plus or minus infinity. Unfortunately, it is not practical to make our numerical domain expand as far as infinity. We have to truncate it in practice. And so that will introduce some sort of error where this idealized boundary condition will not be exactly true at truncated positions. You might think that the subtleties would be more dramatic near the horizon because of behavior like super radiance and things like that. It turns out that that is straightforward to accommodate. A boundary condition like this becomes very, very accurate, even for R star minimum values that aren't all that negative, like R star min equals negative 50. You can come up with a version of this boundary condition that is very accurate without having to jump through a lot of hoops. Unfortunately, that is not true on the large R star side of our domain. Truncating our domain at a finite R star max causes this boundary condition that's idealized to be inconsistent with the retarded solution at that truncated position. And so what we did was an asymptotic analysis in order to develop more sophisticated boundary conditions that allowed us to get an accurate solution with a numerical domain that was relatively small. So we adopted ansatz that involved a representation of the scalar field that was more general. It's an expansion in powers of 1 over R. And we found that if you use that naive boundary condition, you would introduce an error that was like 1 over R max squared. And we don't know what the coefficient of that error is without having solved the problem. But what we had an idea. That idea was, could we use higher derivatives to cancel this error term? And the answer to that question was yes. For example, if in our numerical boundary condition, we include information about the second derivative, then there's a linear combination that we can perform that will cause one of the next term in that error series to cancel. In fact, as far as we can tell, you can do this to higher and higher derivatives and cancel more and more terms in that series of error until this final one is the one we ended up using in practice, which had an error that is dramatically smaller. I'm running out of time, so I'm just going to show you some results that demonstrate that these boundary conditions were successful in allowing us to access smaller errors with a smaller size of our domain. Look how much smaller the error is for the green one, which is our more sophisticated boundary condition. Okay, at this point, we've got the source taken care of. We've got the boundary conditions. We can solve the linear system numerically. And running out of time, so I'll just say we tried multiple methods and we picked the one that was faster. And here are some results. You can see where the world tube is, and inside the world tube is the residual field, and outside is the retarded field. The gradient of that residual field tells us one of the M modes of the self force. We can talk about other numerical results. Nami showed these, how the waveform varies when you change M, or how the waveform varies when you change the spin. And so we tried all sorts of different values for that. And we will want to do convergence tests. The short version is with our second order method converged rather slowly. So we implemented Richardson extrapolation to accelerate convergence, although maybe it would have been better just to use a fourth order method to start with. Finally, we're able to calculate the self force. The self force, you add up all the different M modes. The expected behavior is a 1 over M to the fourth convergence of each term in the sum. Right now, it's pretty close. We're within about 1%. We need to do some systematic convergence tests to make sure that we are getting all the details right. One thing we have not done yet is we have not implemented M mode regularization parameters. That would accelerate convergence even more rapidly. And that is it. So here is a slide with some concluding remarks. We did a bunch of stuff. One thing that I tried and was unsuccessful, this was something that was a side project that I explored. I tried to think about how you would do hyperboloidal slicing and compactification. I can discuss that if you'd like, but that turned out to be unsuccessful, at least my implementation. And some future directions involve using a faster programming language. I have a couple students working on implementing this with a different programming language that's more performant. And in the future, it'd be great to do this for the gravitational case. This also should open up the prospect of doing second order self force calculations based on Lorentz gauge perturbations. I don't see any reason why this wouldn't work for second order. In the future, you could also explore eccentric or inclined orbits. I think it's probably possible to do that with these methods, and I have some ideas to pursue that. And I think I used up all my question time.